Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
In for Angela Davis. You're listening to NPR News, and I'm glad you could join us today. So picture this. You're in physical pain, you go to your doctor, or if it's really serious, you go to the ER, and you describe your symptoms, and you're tired, you're afraid, you want to know what's going on. But if instead of taking your concerns seriously, your doctor tells you that you need to lose weight, or, you know, maybe it's just your stress levels, or maybe it's menstrual pain. For many women, in particular, women of color, this experience is all too familiar, and it can have serious medical and health consequences. Studies have shown that doctors are slower to diagnose women with cancer and heart disease compared to men. And research also shows that African American patients are less likely to receive treatment for cardiovascular disease. Some patients and medical advocates call this experience medical gaslighting. Other experts don't like the provocative term, but they prefer to focus on the medical industry's over-reliance on data that doesn't reflect the health experiences of women and minorities. So we're tackling this hour the experience of medical dismissal, the reasons behind it, and how best to respond both systematically and as individuals. And I want to hear from you. Have you had your medical concerns dismissed by a doctor? Have you been told that your symptoms were due to stress, weight, or hormones, only to receive a serious diagnosis later? The phone lines are open. Give us a call at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. And now I'd like to bring in our guests. Chloe Bird is a senior sociologist at RAND. She studies women health and gender differences in healthcare. Welcome to the show, Chloe.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Lisa Saul is a perinatologist with Allina Health and president of the Mother Baby Clinical Service Line for Allina Health in Children's Minnesota. And I'm glad you could join us.
Thank you for having me today.
So, Chloe, I'll just start with you, just to get everyone sort of on the same page. And so what are people referring to when they use this term medical gaslighting?
Patients have started using this term to describe when they have symptoms that they present to a doctor or other clinician, and they feel they're inappropriately being dismissed. They're treated as if it's minor or possibly primarily psychological. As if their experience isn't real or important.
And, this term may be new, and as I gather, it is new, but dismissing women's health concerns, I mean, goes back a lot farther. I mean, what is the history here that we're talking about?
A lot of terms actually arose out of dismissing women's health concerns. Hysterical, describing hysteria as
very
as,
Victorian,
as
isn't
women's
it?
Yes. Exactly. Yes. So there's this long history of treating women's health as unimportant, that women may be overreacting or malingering because they have chronic conditions or episodic conditions, that that there hasn't been the interest and investment in studying and understanding them.
And
most of the medical, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was just going to say much of the medical research has focused on diseases that were killing men and at earlier ages.
So do you like the term medical gaslighting? Have you found it useful?
I think it's useful if you contextualize it as this is how patients have chosen to talk about their experience. For people who haven't thought of that, it sounds as if it might be purposeful. And I think it's possible that there's a tip of the iceberg that is somehow fits that category. But much of this comes from a lack of understanding, training, appreciation, and a lack of the science foundation on understanding the health of women. So it's not intentional necessarily.
Okay. Well, I'll be probably on and off using the term, but I do want to emphasize that it's within the context, a broader context that you're discussing. So it just wanted to clear that up. And Lisa, I just have to ask you just so what exactly is a perinatologist?
A perinatologist is a physician who is trained in obstetrics and gynecology first as the foundation for their training, and then moves on to specialize in the care of obstetric patients only, addressing the medical complications of pregnancy that can affect a birthing mother, as well as some of the complications that can affect a fetus that we often diagnose on ultrasound using ultrasound techniques.
Okay. So what have you seen, or what has been your experience with medical gaslighting, say, with women during pregnancy?
Well, I think it was important to point out the context of the term, and I appreciate, Chloe, you saying that the intent is not to be dismissive. I think that we probably all have had these experiences where, you know, you have a concern, and in my case, there's a concern that pregnant women have. Because it affects not only them, but also the baby that they are carrying. And in taking care of pregnant patients, it's not uncommon for women to express different symptoms that they are experiencing. And it's up to that care provider to determine, is this under the umbrella of what is usual or typical, understanding that no two pregnancies are the same and no two pregnant women are the same. Or do you rely on what you know, what you've observed, how you've been trained to determine if there really is something that needs further attention and further evaluation?
So with your experience, I mean, what have you found, what works in getting the patient's concerns, you know, their health difficulties that they're feeling? What do you find that works in terms of getting listened to rather than dismissed?
I think it's important to realize that time constraints are a very big factor. And so it is a matter of getting to the point of having that trusting relationship with the patient and establishing that very early. For women to be listened to, it is important to be able to speak up and express the things that are concerning them, but it is also incumbent upon their physician, their midwife, to ask probing questions, to read both the verbal and the nonverbal, and sometimes it is really just us as care providers pulling information out of patients that they may not know to offer or feel uncomfortable offering on their own that will help us make different diagnoses.
Okay. And I have I want to go to the phone lines in just a minute, but I have one more question. Just want to direct it to both of you. And I'll start out with you, Chloe, and then go to you, Lisa. You know, how much does the lack of data, the lack of research, the lack of studies on women's health play a role in the conversation we're having today?
Well, personally, I feel that it underlies the entire problem. Because we have invested so much less, and it continues today, in research on the health of women, in the area of coronary artery disease for the fiscal year 2019, 4.5% of what NIH invested in research in that area went to studies that answered questions specifically on the health of women. As a result, we understand how things such as heart attacks and coronary symptoms present in women, what the disease looks like. Our diagnoses are overfit to men. And so they can tell you you're not having a disease like men. A provider may not know to tell you, you may still be having a disease in the way women do. And it's only recently when we've learned the ways in which the women present with cardiovascular disease in the microvessels of the heart. And it's still real.
Yeah. And Lisa?
And to take that one step further, it is true that the research regarding how certain diseases show up in women is very new. And then when you subdivide that, as you mentioned in your opening, to women of color, that research is even more scarce. And I think we're at a point now where we're seeing a trend of documenting what, in terms of the research, documenting what the problems might be and getting to the point of documenting what those differences between men and women might be. But we need to then take it one step further to getting away from here is the problem to how are we addressing it in terms of solutions to close some of the gaps that we're seeing both between men and women, but also when we subdivide that into our communities of color and those disparity gaps that are well documented.
So, Chloe, Lisa, what I'd like to do now is go to the phone lines, and I'm going to take probably two calls, and then I'll come back to you and get your reactions. You can address their questions or pluck out something that you think is particularly pertinent to our conversation. So first, I want to go to Christine in Hutchinson. And Christine, what is your observation or experience? Hello, Christine. All right. Well, let's go now. Can we go? Let's go to Chandler from St. Paul. Chandler, what is your experience? Okay, so we're not getting through. All right, so who is this? Chandler?
Yeah.
Hi, how are you doing? What is your experience?
My experience is with asthma. And last summer, I was having a bit of a flare-up, and I went to my local ER, and I waited six hours to be seen. They brought me into a room in back, and I was seen by a student, and they said I would not be seen by a doctor today, and they were going to send me to psych based on my my mental health history.
Okay.
So I wasn't seen by a doctor, and I went to psych. I was in tears. I ended up going home, and a few hours later, was back in the ER at a different hospital and had to be treated for an asthma attack.
And are you everything came out okay?
Everything came out great. It was the height of the pandemic. I understand that. But I think based on my mental health history, they made a decision that affected me personally. And it was scary.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate it. And now let's go to Belle in Forest Lake. Belle?
Hi.
Hi. What is your observation?
So I'm a 37-year-old woman. And for many years, I was dismissed and feel discriminated against. For multiple decades, I had multiple miscarriages in my early 20s. And it was dismissed for so long that it wasn't until, kind of like the previous caller, someone finally kind of listened to me that was a student. And I was able to get the situation corrected. And it's just so frustrating to feel that, you know, my age, my weight, my gender is the entirety of the basis of the treatment of care that I'm receiving. My mother was misdiagnosed for 20 years for something that ended up becoming Hashimoto's, thyroiditis, and it affected her deeply. She was in and out of hospitals constantly, and they just chalked it up to mental health and age and gender. It's so frustrating to not be heard in a space where we should be heard.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your story. I really appreciate that. And Lisa, I'll go to you first and then Chloe. And so, Lisa, any reactions, thoughts to the stories of Chandler or Belle?
Yes, I really appreciate hearing those stories. And it is obviously disappointing to hear, especially a decades-long struggle. Belle mentioned her mother with their thyroid disease, and then, of course, her own experience with miscarriages. I think that it is that listening component. And as Belle mentioned, it was a student. And I don't know if it was a resident doctor or if it was a medical student that was listening to her. I think it is a combination of really listening to what the story is. And I think as patients, myself included, I think it is also most helpful to have as much knowledge or as much of your own history as possible to present to that care provider that's caring for you, so that as much of the history is known, so that then ideally it would prompt more questions and a deeper dive into what's going on.
And Chloe?
Well, I think this reflects this problem where women present very often with what are called non-specific symptoms. For going back to the heart attack example, men are more likely to have these classic symptoms, clutching a heart. It looks like a heart attack on TV. That happens sometimes in women, but women also experience other much more vague symptoms that could be other things. And because it could be other things, it's very easy for providers to go to. It could be stress. It could be indigestion. It could be some other, onset of some other illness that's just, a passing stomach bug or something. And women also are more likely to have had a history of depression. Overall, men and women have the same average of mental health, but the conditions that women present with are more likely to be depression. And this fits into this narrative, this story that, this may have more to do with your mental health history. And it's that women end up being treated as if they're exaggerating their symptoms in some way. And yet, we've known for a long time that women are equally reliable to men in reporting symptoms. They just have a wider set because of some of the kinds of chronic diseases that they experience, some of these underlying conditions that cause pain or discomfort or loss of energy in the case of the thyroid problems. And we need to be training clinicians better in how to do a differential diagnosis in the face of these circumstances.
Let's
listen to their patients.
Yeah. So let's go back to both what you just said, Chloe and Lisa, spark all kinds of questions from me. But I want to go back to the listeners and give them an opportunity. And let's go to Christine in Hutchinson. Christine?
Hopefully it works this time.
Working just fine. We can all hear you.
Very good. Very good. My story actually ties in really well with what Chloe and Lisa were just saying. A little bit of backstory. I had been diagnosed with Crohn's disease when I was 13 years old, which is really early for Crohn's. But Crohn's is similar to like colitis or IBS, and that symptoms usually manifest as like intestinal upset and diarrhea. So fast forward several years, I'd been dealing with Crohn's for about 7 years of my life at this point, and then I was a really young mom at 20, and I had just had my second daughter. Then one day I wasn't feeling very well. I had some cramps and some diarrhea, not terribly unusual. But what was really unusual was that I was also really nauseous, and my temperature was a little high. So I decided to go to the doctor because it was getting worse. And as soon as the doctor at urgent care heard that I had Crohn's, he said it was probably just a flare-up caused by new baby stress and that I just needed some rest. Ran zero tests, not one. So I went back to our apartment to try to rest, try to drink lots of water, eat soft foods. But within about 2 days, with continued diarrhea and vomiting, I was so dehydrated and weak that my husband had to carry me to our car to take me to the ER because I couldn't walk. I could barely hold my head up. Once I was admitted to the ER, I spent 3 days in the ICU recovering from a salmonella infection. And my general practitioner told me later that after reviewing my vitals when I was admitted, that had I waited just another hour or two to come in that night, that I might not have made it. Just to the severe dehydration caused by all of that.
I'm glad that you're able to talk to us today and tell us your story.
It was very traumatic. Thankfully, we're able to look back at it, and we can joke about it now, but it's very scary to think about.
It's very scary. Well, thank you for calling in. And now let's go to Claire in Minneapolis. Claire?
Hi, good morning. I have a similar story to so many of these other callers, except it was with my infant son. And, you know, pretty much as soon as he was born, I was kind of talking with our primary care physician and saying, like, hey, I think there's something wrong. He seems to be throwing up a lot, and told, no, that's sped up. That's normal. And saying, hey, he seems to be really sick and fussy and not gaining weight, and saying, no, that's normal. And kind of after several months of this back and forth, I ended up calling kind of like the clinic's emergency urgent care line and being really dismissed by the care provider, then saying, no, this is completely normal. You don't know what you're talking about. You know, this is fine. You know, calm down, mom. And I ended up taking him into Children's Hospital later that day, where he was admitted for the next 10 days, five of which in the pediatric ICU, and later diagnosed with a chronic endocrine condition, which, you know, is scary and everything else. But I think what kind of really impacted me the most out of all of this was just kind of losing my sense of knowing, like, what's wrong and what kind of needs to get pushed back. Because for so long, you know, we had been told by professionals, by people who had gone to school for a really long time, that no, everything was okay. You know, it was just kind of in my head when, you know, kind of my instinct was saying, no, there's something really wrong here.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in. And now let's, I want to go back to Lisa and Chloe. And I'm going to start off with you, Chloe, and toward the end of your previous remarks, you know, you were, how can we start coming up with solutions? You know, these stories about dismissal, stories of not being taken seriously. So when you hear, you know, what Christine and Claire were saying, and then it's really building on what Chandler and Belle were saying, take us a step toward, how do we come toward solutions?
Well, I think there are two parts to this. One, I think especially Christine and Claire's stories speak to the need as patients when you are experienced something is very wrong to continue to speak up and to look for someone who will listen and either explain in a way that it becomes perfectly clear why it's normal and what you'd be looking for that would indicate it's not normal. What would they need to hear? What do you need to pay attention to? Because if it's supposed to be reassuring, it's not working. You're not reassured. And if you want to be able to convey what's going on, you need to know how to tell them this story, how to present it effectively. And it's often easier for women to advocate for others, as Claire did for her son, than for themselves. Because they look at their lives and think, yeah, I am stressed. This is hard. I am tired.
Yeah.
And so it's difficult to speak up for yourself. At the same time, we can be doing a much better job, throughout the medical curriculum of incorporating the latest, knowledge, the latest research on the health of women. That's something that the American Medical Women's Association has taken on pushing, and they're working with the American Medical College Association to upgrade the training. I'm working with people in the Office for Research on Women's Health and with others who are leading in what do we know and what do we not know about women's health? What will it look like to start to do research that will close those gaps?
And Lisa, the same question to you, you know, with the stories that we're hearing and, you know, most recently from Christine and Claire, and I imagine you could identify with some of those circumstances that they were dealing with. I imagine you've seen circumstances similar to theirs. And thinking about how do we resolve this or how do we move toward, you know, solutions?
Yeah, I was listening to those stories and reflecting on my own experiences. And I know for sure I became a better physician when I became a parent and needing to advocate on behalf of someone other than myself made me recognize what my role as a physician is in terms of being that listening ear. But also what I found is a common thread during those stories is, you know, as physicians, there is also the impact of time. Sometimes we cannot make a diagnosis real time in that moment. And there is the benefit of time passing to see if something stays the same, gets better, does get worse. But I do also think it's incumbent upon us to map out the plan. And we were just talking about that. Chloe was just talking about that in terms of if this doesn't happen in this period of time, I want to see you again. This is what it should look like if it's getting better. This is what I'm expecting it to look like. If it gets worse, this is what our next plan of action would be. It's hard to hear about a baby going months and months and months with those same symptoms. And I think that as patients, and again, as I have learned myself with my own family and my own children, I think that's an appropriate question and a course to take is, this is how I'm feeling. I'm explaining to you how I am feeling. This is different than my usual asthma. This is very different than the way that my Crohn's usually presents. And this is why. If we are not doing something today, then in what time period will the plan change? In what time period will I get labs? In what time? And I think that having those kinds of conversations, and I'm not taking the responsibility off of the physicians and no. other care providers at all. But I also think in terms of your question about how can we change it, I think it is changing the conversations and changing the expectations of the result of those conversations so that there's a clear path forward with some of those benchmarks as to when the plan may change.
Yeah, no, I like that. It's very, very practical. So, you know, we've talked about women and, you know, obviously incredibly important. But I wonder if you could also address transgender and gender non-binary people. I mean, what can you tell us about how, you know, transgender and non-binary people are being treated by doctors these days and some of the challenges?
It's a great question, and I think it leads to the conversation we were having earlier about the disparities that we see in healthcare, unconscious bias in a number of different ways, as well as where we are on our learning curve about different patient populations and how we can best take care of them. We've already talked in this hour about women as an entire patient population that we're still just trying to figure out how are we best taking care of them, what sorts of research we're doing to differentiate different diagnoses and symptoms and improve those outcomes. And I think for our transgender patients, we have a long way to go. There's a lot of education that is still needed. A lot of training, both sensitivity and otherwise, to make sure that patients that are transgender are receiving the same care as every other patient, being communicated with as respectfully and as openly and honestly as every other patient. And I think right now our country is at a place where we're on a steep learning curve in terms of how best to support transgender patients and their specific needs. We see that showing up quite frequently these days in my world, in the OBGYN and perinatology space. And in my organization, we've taken the time and the effort to really be intentional about training, about role playing, about educating ourselves in terms of what needs of many of our patient populations are, and the transgender population would be one of them. This is a population that, you know, faces as much discrimination as many of our groups of color do. And oftentimes because there's such a lack of understanding of what they are facing from a medical perspective, there are many things that go undiagnosed, dismissed, and unnoticed, simply out of lack of knowledge and understanding.
And Chloe, I like that expression that Lisa used, steep learning curve.
Yes, we're definitely on a steep learning curve. And I think it's particularly important as what transgender patients and a range of sexual minorities do for themselves is finding a physician, finding a provider who listens and will engage with them in this learning curve. You have an opportunity when you're generally well to see if the provider you're seeing is somebody who listens to you. Does the communication work? That may be all the more important if you have ever experienced or are more at risk of experiencing being dismissed. And for these patients, it's not some of the things that the rest of us can do more easily are less available. We've got a lot of work showing that gender or race concordance, seeing a provider who is the same gender as you, seeing a provider who's the same racial or ethnic group as you, is associated in some kinds of treatment with better care and outcomes, possibly because of better listening. Possibly because of different assumptions, but we definitely can see where that helps. But these patients face a lot of the same issues that women do, where the healthcare system is very fragmented around women's health, having been built around treating men as a norm. So it's a particular challenge when you need some information actually from all the different parts of the system to come together. So you need a clinician who's going to do some of that thinking with you and is embracing that learning curve, because the answers aren't already in their pocket.
Let's go back to the phone lines. And Lisa and Chloe, same thing. I'll take a couple calls and then I'll come back to you for some comments, some observations. And first, I want to go to Megan in St. Paul. And Megan, what is your experience?
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate this conversation a lot. I wanted to provide an example that I think illustrates a lot of the topics that have come up on this call. In my early 30s, I went to four different physicians when I was living in New York at the time, with some classic gynecological appearing symptoms like bloating, extreme lower back pain, pelvic and abdominal pain. But the unique symptom was trouble eating and feeling very full very quickly. I'm a healthy, good eater. I have a good appetite. That's a very strange symptom. I saw a gynecologist who dismissed it, a female gynecologist. I went one day to in crying, in extreme pain, to an ER, just lower back pain, bloating. The ER physician said, dismissed me, sent me home saying I was drug seeking, you know, 32-year-old white woman in New York at the time. Hmm. I went and saw a gastroenterologist because of this abdominal bloating and this strange inability to eat. I didn't feel like I had GI symptoms, but I couldn't eat food. and the full workup, the GI physician diagnosed me with irritable bowel syndrome. And I went throughout all of this process. I went and saw my primary care physician many times in tears. And that's very unusual for me. I'm kind of a bullheaded, tough person. So I asked my primary care physician, I said, something is wrong and no one has found it. And I said, can I please have a CT scan? She told me no. And she said, providing you a CT scan is giving you the same amount of radiation as a flight from Minneapolis or from New York City to LA 17 times. And fortunately for me, I ignored all of them. And I fought and fought and fought, being a very bullheaded, tough person. And I finally found a physician that would do a CT scan, which revealed ovarian cancer. Oh. When I finally was diagnosed with ovarian cancer at 32, the surgical or the gynecological oncologist said 95% of patients wouldn't have found this for a year. And I give this as an example because, you know, ovarian cancer is one of the most deadly cancers for women. And I saw remarkable physicians, folks with good pedigrees, so-called, who all assumed that it was not important and did not merit examination and testing. And I say to women, I want them to be aware of these symptoms because it is one of the deadlier cancers folks can have. I was assumed to be drug-seeking as a, professional-looking white woman. I know I wouldn't be here if I were a woman of color. I don't doubt that for a second in my life. I wanted to, before I pass it along, just say, on your point of you asked your panelists to talk about solutions, I took my own experience and also became very active with the Minnesota Ovarian Cancer Alliance, and they fund research. We don't have a test for ovarian cancer, and being such a deadly illness, it's pretty outrageous. And they do remarkable work, advocacy, and just in 2022, we approved over $1 million for the first year ever in research.
That's
for
great.
Women experiencing ovarian cancer. So I want to thank you for the show. And
thank you. Thank you so much for
the conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling in. Let's go to Meg from Minneapolis. And Meg, what is your story?
Hi. Yeah. Again, thanks for this conversation for women and people who were assigned female birth. I think this is really, really important to have. I had an experience, the most dramatic experience of medical gaslighting when I was pregnant with my first. I woke up in the middle of the night with terrible, awful, excruciating pain in my right side. It was so painful I couldn't sit up. I couldn't walk. I was throwing up. I was violently ill. And in the ER, I was told that, this is just morning sickness. I had had chronic morning sickness, but I was vomiting because I was in so much pain. And a nurse even was like, if you think this is bad, what is childbirth going to be like? They weren't taking my pain seriously at all. And we were very concerned that it was possibly appendicitis, but nobody was listening and nobody was taking care of my pain. And it took me grabbing my husband by the front of his shirt and pulling him down to the bed to say, this is how women die in the ER because they are not helping me. And it's him stepping in more loudly and more directly and more aggressively. It took him advocating for me to get my, my pain managed and to move treatment along. I ended up having to have my gallbladder removed. So it is something that you hear about, but you don't recognize until after the fact, like, oh, this was crazy making. And I learned from that experience to ask them to document their refusal to help me in my chart. And it has changed things to be directly, I hear that you don't want to do this. I need you to please document this for me. And it's made them think twice about just sending me away just on a no when I don't have someone with me and irritatingly a male person with me to help advocate for what I need.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. And Chloe, it doesn't seem to me like it's a systemic solution, but both of these stories, the importance of being an advocate, your own advocate or having someone that's going to be an advocate for you.
It's invaluable to be able to be your own advocate. And I And I speak to that as a solution with some sadness, because it plays on whatever privilege you can use to get treated. It is, as Megan noted, a different story for poor African American women and other women of color presenting, because they may not be listened to the same way. We know, in fact, that they aren't listened to in the same way. And the story about ovarian cancer is deeply disturbing, because it is why it is so lethal. There's not a test. The kinds of symptoms get dismissed, and it takes a long time for that presentation, the prodrome, the onset, to get to a point. And Lisa was referring to this too, to where there's something done differently. So your capacity to negotiate and say, what are we going to do when, if this happens again? What are we doing right now? Can you rule out something? And I have even resorted at one point to the same, the last caller's point of saying, can you just document that you're not able to treat this right now? And that gives pause to the clinicians, to the institutions that are dismissing someone because they'd like to do a better job of documenting that they looked.
Yeah. And Lisa?
Well, especially with the last two callers, one of the things that was a highlight in my mind, there were several, but the importance of having not only yourself to be able to advocate for you, but it is helpful when there is another individual in the room that knows that patient very well. And one of the impacts of COVID-19 and the pandemic was that was limited just based on the ability for others to be present in the emergency rooms and at appointments and things like that. And while I know the last caller was specifically pointing out that it took her husband, a man, to be able to get that attention, and that wasn't lost on me, I also know that the individual who is in acute distress, it is also helpful for that person, for it not to be their responsibility to convey everything that's going on. And sometimes it is very helpful to have another individual that knows that person well, who isn't in acute distress, to be able to convey that message. And it is not always possible, especially now with the restrictions that we have in place. It is, everyone does not have that someone. So I recognize that too, but that has been helpful. That is why, one of the reasons why doulas are very helpful in a pregnancy, because they can be that individual to advocate on behalf of their patient. And not in an antagonistic way. It, you know, we don't come to these situations to fight.
Right. No.
But
no.
I think it is important to have that other set of eyes and ears sometimes that can also say, and remember the other night you were feeling this too. That can be that added piece of information that is very helpful and takes some of that responsibility off of the person who is in acute pain or acute discomfort, or just exasperated and frustrated because they've been experiencing these symptoms for a very long time. So I just wanted to make that point too, is that's very helpful to the care team to listen to all inputs to try to piece puzzles together when the puzzle isn't straightforward.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines and Gail in St. Louis Park. And, what is your experience?
This is Gail.
Yep.
And I have a positive experience to share. I am in my 60s, and I went in for my annual checkup. I'm generally very healthy, but have a history of stress, and more stressful work, stressful grief, etc. And when I went in for my annual checkup, I said, I think there's something that's not right. I'm less resilient. I don't know what it is. It could be pandemic stress. And I said, but the oddest thing is that lately when I leave the house to go to work, I find myself hoping that I don't die in front of strangers on the bus or something. And my physician said, listen very carefully. And she said, I think we should do a heart workup. So we did a heart workup, and they found a very serious heart condition. And if it hadn't been for my doctor hearing me and listening to me, I wouldn't have known about it.
Well, I am very happy that your doctor listened to you. It's a very good thing.
Yeah.
And it's been one of the themes of the hour. So thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate it. And let's see, we're really running down toward the end of our time. I'm going to try and squeeze in one more call. And this is Malika in St. Paul. And Malika, if you could just keep it short, please.
Okay, I'll try. I was 35, and I had a tubal ligation. 5 years later, I passed out on my kitchen floor when I should have been at work. I woke up with all my hair, very long hair, all wet. Went to the doctor and was told I was having a bad period. I went to work. I felt like a bowl full of jelly.
Mm.
The same thing happened again. I went back to the doctor again and told the story. And 2 days later, he said I had an infection. Previously, he said I'd had a bad period. Wait for a month. The next time it was an infection, a sexually transmitted infection, which I didn't have. And I ended up in Brainerd in the hospital with a tubal pregnancy. I almost died. I actually almost died three times because that extreme pain, three times.
I'm so sorry that happened.
The warning to, no, I'm not sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry, but I want people to know if you've had a tubal ligation, had your tubes tied, you need to be aware that the very, very few people who get pregnant after that can die of a tubal pregnancy.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in. And unfortunately, our time is up for the day. And thank you to all the people who are waiting on the line. Thank you for your calls. And I want to thank our guests. Chloe Bird is a senior sociologist at RAND, and she studies women health and gender differences in healthcare. Dr. Lisa Saul is a perinatologist with Alina Health and president of the Mother Baby Clinical Service Line for Alina Health and Children's Minnesota. This conversation was produced by Sarah Gelbart and Samantha Matsumoto. And be safe, everyone.
Thanks for listening to a recording of my live radio show on NPR News. A reminder that if you want to catch my show in real time, tune in and call in weekdays at 9 a.m.